Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. It's October 6, 2014. We got some great guests on tonight. We got Brendan Palferin. He's the beer trademark lawyer. We're going to talk about beer trademarks. Basil and Kevin from Finback, a great new brewery in Queens. And Tony Forder, Ale Street News. We're going to give a GABF recap. So this is a special show. GABF kind of takes up a lot of people's attention and energy. And it's you know, probably the most noted consumer tasting in America for beer. Tony, what does GABF mean? I mean, why is it so big? Why is everybody going to it?
Well, it's Great American Beer Festival, 33rd year this year. Basically, it's a showcase of what's going on in the U.S. And I think this year, it enlarges every year. They kind of cap the attendance to 12,000 per session. There's four sessions, and the tickets get gobbled up really quickly. But what's neat about it, I found this year, was you've got the big guys and little guys. Everyone's mixed in together, brew pubs, everything. And then there's also the competition, which, you know, gets a lot of attention.
So some of our local, like New York and Jersey brewers, won some prizes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You got Gun Hill, Chris Sheehan. He's won before with his style. He seems to be the master at foreign style stout. He won a gold for his Void of Light. The Grim Artisanal, new guys from New York, got a silver for their double negative stout in the imperial stout category. Peekskill NYPA took a silver. One of our guys from New Jersey, Kane, got the gold for their barrel-aged strong stout. An old favorite from down in Philly, Tom Baker, you probably know him, Earthbred, he won gold for his Percuno's Hammer for the Baltic-style porter. Flying Fish won a gold and a silver over in Jersey. And who do you think won Belgian-style triple? Golden Monkey, that beer's been around for a while. And there's some other perennial winners, like Trogs Trojanator seems to win the bot category almost every year. Down in Virginia, the Devil's Backbone won.
So it's not just for, we're going to talk more about later, so it's not just for new beers. It's you could submit every year by style.
Absolutely, yeah. Perennial winners like Alaska Smoke Porter is the most medal-winning beer there, and it got a bronze this year, too. Wow. So that is interesting that these beers, they win consistently. So you got over 200 international judges judging the competition.
So. No, that's great, and we're going to talk more about that in the show. We got a long show today. We're going to segue from this at some point. We're going to talk about beer trademarks, which Brendan came down. Where are you from, Brendan? Syracuse?
Yep, moved up to Syracuse from Brooklyn about a year and a half ago.
And then you're in a law firm, but you're targeting breweries and
I work for Harris Beach. We've got offices all over the state, and I'm trying to develop a practice there where we're helping out brewers, craft brewers, cider makers, distilleries, everything. Get the word out there about how important trademarks are.
Great, and that's going to be a big part of the show. And Basil Lee and Kevin Stafford from Finback, one of our new favorite breweries in New York City. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, and what's new at Finback right now? I know you've had some great new beers coming out. Finback Moby Hop is on tap of Jimmy's Number 43.
Yeah, that's our Imperial IPA, which we love a lot. We just came out with a pumpkin IPA, a coffee porter that was brewed with a cold brew from Stumptown. We have a holiday sour we're going to put out pretty soon, and a bunch of big dark beers for this winter.
And you're still self-distributing, right?
Still self-distributing. You know, enjoying it. It's definitely getting more and more tiresome getting out in the van, but it's still good, you know, making it out to our accounts. Definitely getting a workout still, so that's great. Having fun, brewing lots of new beers, and doing lots of events and really just kind of being part of the New York craft beer scene, and you know, almost a year in, and it still feels really great.
That's great. Well, going back to GABF, the Great American Beer Fest. If you don't know the is that an acronym, Tony? GABF?
GABF, yes.
Great American Beer Fest. Why did you guys not participate? It seems that like some New York breweries, like Grimm's, is real small. They sent in and they won a prize.
Yeah, actually, so we're super excited about all of the kind of New York City and New York winners. Congratulations to all of them. Honestly, there was no good reason we didn't enter. It was something that, when the submission kind of came out, we were still like getting started in terms of opening the breweries and just really didn't have our head around, trying to enter or attend. So we did neither, but, definitely next year it's going to be on our radar.
I mean, if you win a prize, it means something, doesn't it? I mean, it's definitely newsworthy. Tony,
you can make a lot of whatever it costs you to enter, and you win a medal. You can definitely pay it back. People pay attention to. This list is out on the internet as soon as the results are announced on the Saturday, and there are people all over the country just downloading it and checking out who won the awards.
Yeah, I saw Dave Lopez, one of the owners of Gun Hill Brewing from the Bronx, last night, and they were really proud that they won. Foreign export style.
Exactly. I mean, you're competing with brewers from all over the country, and for a new brewery like that to win, obviously they've got a very seasoned brewer, Chris Sheehan there. It's definitely something to brag, especially for the small guys. You're going up against some of these categories. I mean, you could probably guess the largest category of entries, IPA, 279 entries into IPA. So if you win a medal there, you're doing pretty good.
All right. Well, if you guys were going to submit, this time we did it all over again, Finback, what beer would you pick to say you want to showcase on a national level?
Actually, I would choose our BQE, which is our Imperial Stout. We brewed it early this year, and it was kind of a celebration of our two roots, Brooklyn, where we live, and Queens, where we now work and brew. It's got some chocolate from Mass Brothers in Brooklyn and some coffee from Native Roasters in Queens. So an Imperial Stout, which I think it's a really strong beer, and it would have been something fun to enter.
All right. Let's steer to the real point of the show today. We're talking about beer trademarks, and everyone here has something to say about it. But Brendan, as a segue, so, for example, the significance of submitting your beers to GABF. Tell us your background and why you're preaching to breweries about registering trademarks and the kind of jobs that you're trying to get.
Sure. So basically, when you're starting up a brewery, what you're thinking about most times, unless you're coming into it as a lawyer, is your licenses, federal, state. You're thinking about your bright tanks, your mash tuns, your payroll, your EIN number, that type of thing. But oftentimes, you don't think about the trademark, which can be really, really important, because what's the most important piece of property that a brewery can have? Is it a particular mash tun, a bright tank? I would say it's usually the trademark, because if you have to switch names or there's some problem down the line, somebody's going to walk into a bar and not be able to associate the tap with your brewery, which is all the brand recognition you've built up.
All right. And then so Kevin and Vasil, so did you guys have an issue with trademarks or labels when you started out?
We did. We had a little issue, funny enough, with one of the largest craft brewers in the country. Originally, we were called Narwhal, which is this cool one-toothed, one-horned whale, kind of like the unicorn of the sea. And we were using that name for about 2 years, so starting in 2011. So we kind of, our business name, and all officially, we're actually still called Narwhal. But we, were building our brand, we were doing a lot of homebrew competitions, and then in 2 years later, Sierra Nevada, we found out was releasing their Imperial Stout, which actually won third place in GABF this year. And so we kind of reached out to them and started the discussion basically saying that, we'd been using that name and that we were building our brand and imminently opening a brewery. And discussions went really well at first, and they were actually really, really nice, really cordial, really supportive. And that was great. And then, this is a pure hypothesis, my personal opinion only, but they actually, and this is kind of the perfect timing for this, they won silver at GABF that year, and then the tone of the discussion pretty much changed after that.
Is this common, Brendan? I mean, have you seen a lot of cases like this?
Yeah, it's becoming more and more common, almost day by day. I think we're at somewhere between 3,000, 4,000 breweries, brews in planning right now, and each one of them is making 5-10 beers. You know, there's
so you're saying they even trademark the name of the beer. So they're trademarking the brewery name, and then like the unique. Why do they have to? Why does everyone have to have like a name for their IPA? Why can't they just say?
Well, how many hot bums are there out there?
But why can't you just say, you know, such and such brewery IPA? Why does everyone have to have a unique name for their beer?
There are a couple breweries that do that. You know, I think Smutty Nose, some of their beers are just, I think that's Smutty Nose IPA. I don't know the finest kind and the Star A, but I think there are a lot of breweries that do that, maybe to avoid these issues. I think the reason that they don't is that it's hard to get people to remember your beer. I looked at the Beer Advocate top 100 or top 250 beers the other, probably about a week ago, and I could go all the way down the list, and I saw one beer that was just named after what it was. I think it was Sean Hill's Galaxy Double IPA. Every other beer had a name. Like, would you remember Alchemist IPA as much as Alchemist Heady Topper?
Well, I remember Heady Topper, and I can't remember who made it.
But, exactly.
Right? And what about you guys? You guys have so many names, too. I've got the Moby Hop. What did you just pour for us, Kevin? This is great.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, this is the Le Porter Caldi. This is the coffee porter we just made.
It's great.
Well, yeah, it's 6.8%. You know, cold brew coffee was added after fermentation. Yeah, simple recipe.
Are you going to trademark the name of the beer?
I have to say, after we had our little issue with Sierra Nevada, we did go trademark crazy for a while, and we're trademarking every idea we had.
You know, for a Kelso, Kelly Taylor here in New York, he had a slogan, it's because beer helps. And he came in one day and was really proud that he got that trademark. Mm-hmm. So I guess we're all onto something. Tony, you know, your experience, you know, you've been around the world, you've been mondial mm-hmm. with Ale Street News.
There is a famous trademark that Sam Adams made years ago at the GABF when they didn't have the full tilt professional judging competition. It was a consumer poll, and he won it for a couple of years, and so he trademarked Best Beer in America. And it created a lot of rancor amongst the other brewers, and he eventually agreed to give it up.
But how does that work, Brent? I mean, if he actually trademarked that phrase, would that stand, or isn't that like a generic phrase?
Yeah, exactly, and good use of generic there. You can't trademark, at least initially, things that are either descriptive or generic. So you couldn't trademark IPA. You couldn't trademark cold beer or hoppy beer because it's just describing what the product is. There is an exception.
Like could I trademark corner restaurant? No.
Probably not, especially if you're on a corner, because it can't describe what you're doing. Yeah. One thing you can do is if you have the mark for long enough. So, for example, Boston Beer Company, which everyone knows is Sam Adams over company, that's just descriptive of a beer company in Boston. But if you can show that the mark has what's called acquired distinctiveness, which you can get by 5 years of substantially continuous use, then you can trademark it oftentimes.
Wow.
So like Beer Sessions Radio, for example.
It's trademarked, right?
It's trademarked.
TM.
What if I write TM next to things? That's what I do.
That's what you want to do if you don't have a trademark yet. If you have a trademark, a federal trademark, you put the little circle R. But it's very important not to use that unless you have the actual federal trademark.
Well, that was transcendental meditation.
Well, that's kind of what this is like. All right, so tell me more. Tell me about this beer, because this is an awesome coffee porter.
It's a good breakfast beer, right? You just want to wake up in the morning. If you're like me and you drink beer in the morning, you can drink this beer because it's got coffee in it as well.
So how many beers are you making right now? I mean, you've made at least 10, haven't you?
Oh, we've brewed at least, I mean, since we opened in January, we probably brewed maybe 20, 25 different beers. You know, our whole philosophy is that we've got maybe two or three beers that we try to keep on all the time, although sometimes we run out of things and we don't get our production schedule just right, but we try to keep things going, you know, consistently for three of our beers, and everything else we kind of rotate around Really just like kind of from our homebrew backgrounds, we like to experiment a lot and like to make different recipes. And so the idea is to just keep brewing new things.
Great. And so with Narwhal and then Finback, why did you guys go with the whale identity?
Yeah, I think it was just an easy transition with the marketing we already had in place. We didn't really have to change much. We could reuse a lot of the same material on the website, Facebook, and everything.
Almost lucky. I think Finback's a better name than Narwhal.
Yeah, me too. I think it rolls off the tongue a little easier. Yeah, I think it's better.
I agree.
But
yeah,
I'm still bitter.
But why did you come up with Narwhal in the first place?
So Narwhal, I'm from Rhode Island originally. Kevin's from Massachusetts. So we knew we wanted to do something kind of nautical, kind of coastal, ocean related. And then, Kevin's also just like an animal fanatic. And so he kind of...
I would say freak.
Freak, that's right.
It's a technical term.
And the narwhal is one of the most kind of mysterious and kind of magical creatures of the ocean. And
so where do you find one?
And, in like Greenland, in the kind of North Atlantic kind of ocean. I mean, they're all around. They're pretty cool.
Is it kind of like Bigfoot? Kind of like it's there and then it's gone?
Yeah, it's the Loch Ness Monster for the whale world.
They'll call a bit of Bigfoot, by the way.
What are you drinking, Basil? Because you brought your coffee porter, but you're drinking something out of the can.
We're just drinking
your own beer.
Anderson
Valley. Let's try that. That looks pretty good, too.
So
Brandon, so this label, look, it says Anderson Valley, the Kimmy, the Yank, and the Holy Goza Ale, Highway Boonville 128 Session Series. Now, is that stuff all trademarked? Or
yeah,
they just made up all these names?
I don't see a circle R on there. I'd be surprised. I'm sure Anderson Valley Brewing Company is trademarked. The other two, if they haven't trademarked it, they should. And if they have trademark, they should put the circle R in there.
But what point does it end? I mean, it's like this creativity of labels and stuff. I mean, it's like, I mean,
with the labels, I often recommend doing copyright, which is different than trademark. Copyright is sort of creative works of authorship that are put into some tangible form, like a beer bottle. So a book, a play, a movie, those types of things are copyrighted. And for brewers, you can trademark the entire label if you wanted to, but trademarks, the core of it goes to the source identifying the brand, the, Lagunitas, the name of the particular beer, not as much the entire label. Although you can have logos, like the logo for Sam Adams, I'm sure the guy, with the old school haircut and the revolutionary wardrobe is, I'm sure that's trademarked as well.
I mean, I think, trademark, for us, we definitely got a crash course in it, probably up to, I guess it would have been at least 4 months before we opened, and then definitely more sensitive about it after we opened. I think it's kind of like a love-hate kind of thing. Originally, when we looked for our name, we searched everything. We looked at, all the kind of beer blogs, Google, Untappd, things like that. And we made sure that that name didn't exist, which is really what you're supposed to do before you file for a trademark. And then after we saw that no one was using it, we're like, okay, let's start using it. And then didn't have the follow through to actually file for a trademark. And then after we learned our lesson, we definitely, as Kevin said, went kind of trademark crazy. And it's kind of one of those things where, on the one hand, it's really simple for all intents and purposes to get a trademark, as a kind of administrative thing. I mean, you got to do the research and everything, but it's not really difficult in principle. But then if you're making 20 beers, it does get really difficult to trademark everything. And especially if you make a beer that you may only sell, we're a small brewery. We may sell 40 barrels of it and never brew it again. And it's kind of like one of those things where, should you or shouldn't you? Because maybe 2 years later, you do want to brew it again and it becomes really popular. And if you didn't trademark it, you might be kicking yourself in the behind. But otherwise, it's one of those things where you just kind of, you got to kind of find the right balance, I think.
You are forced to protect it, though, if you have a trademark. Right? I thought this whole trademark thing was all just to give lawyers a bunch of money.
I think it is, but let's just slow down. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. It's good. We're getting somewhere. This is good.
So, you like good beer. Whether you're a craft beer pro or just had your first sip of an IPA, GreatBrewers.com is your number one beer resource on the internet. GreatBrewers.com bridges the gap between the world's great brewers and the consumers who enjoy their products. With so much information and misinformation out there, GreatBrewers.com focuses on education and leaves no stone unturned. Take the Great Beer Test on their website and browse through an extensive product catalog. Download their mobile Beer Cloud app, which includes a GPS beer finder, a beer sommelier, and descriptions for over 5,000 different brews. What are you waiting for? Back up that passion for craft beer with some solid information and education. Visit GreatBrewers.com today.
Hi, I'm Mike Mills with 17th Street Barbecue in Murfreesboro, Illinois. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.org.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. That was so cool. Mike Mills, the barbecue guy, was promoting Heritage Radio Network. And you know, we were here on Friday in the back of Roberta's. Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, was here. It was a great event. Alice Waters, Carlo Petrini. Those are the roots of Heritage Radio Network. Check it out. Go to heritageradionetwork.org. Become a member. You're supporting something that's 25 years now. Slow Food is 25 years. So we're here talking about trademarks and beers and GABF and also homebrewing. So Brandon Palfrey-Men.
That's it.
He's the trying to be the beer lawyer for trademarks, but he's really a homebrewer too. And we've met each other at many beer events, and we've met also at Cooperstown. At Belgium, yep. Comes to Cooperstown. Mm-hmm. So tell us more about you as a homebrewer, because it's informing you as a lawyer.
Sure. Got into homebrewing when I was in law school, Brooklyn Law, and I started at the Brooklyn Fleet. At One Hanson Place with a kit from Brooklyn Brew Shop. You may have had those guys on the show before.
Sure,
they're great.
Yeah.
1 gallon kit, I think it was a pale ale, and at my little tiny apartment in Windsor Terrace. And I just fell in love. And I've been brewing pretty much once a month since then. Entered a lot of competitions last year because I just sort of got into the competition. The Knickerbocker, Battle of the Brews up in Saratoga, the New York State Fair, which is put on by my homebrew club, the Salt City.
So the New York
City
State
Brew
Fair
club.
Has a homebrew competition.
Yep, it's put on by the Salt City Homebrew Club, which is Syracuse's homebrew club, of which I'm a member now. And just pretty much ones throughout New York and wherever, as far as I can get a FedEx within 1 or 2 days.
So there's a cool beer scene in Syracuse.
Yeah, definitely a burgeoning scene. There's two really established breweries, Empire. I'm sure you've had some Empire guys on the show. And then Middle Ages is the other old one. But there's all sorts of new ones popping up. There's Eastwood Brewing Company. Opening soon, there's one called Red Hawk, another one called Westcott, another one called Local 315, which is the area code up there. So it's taken off, yeah.
Wow. Tony, and with Ale Street News, have you heard about the new breweries upstate? There's so many.
Yeah,
new breweries.
I actually did a tour up there. There's a group called Brew Central New York. They have a website, and they're supporting six counties to the east of the Finger Lakes, which is known for wine. They're promoting breweries and cideries and distilleries, all micro stuff going on in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Syracuse and Empire is building a farm brewery in Cazenovia, I believe, a big project. So it all goes along with a farm brewery license, too, which is really taking off up in
there. Yeah, that's huge. There's a ton of farm breweries that are taking advantage of that new licensing option.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, and going back to homebrewers, so Kevin and Basil, you guys started as homebrewers, and tell us about your journey, because I know you were part of a very cool scene. And
It started off with a Mr. Beer kit that I got for Christmas, and you know, I was brewing once a week.
How old were you?
It was 10 years ago. I don't know, 24 maybe. But yeah, I started brewing, you know, once a week. That turned into 2 weeks. Upgraded my system again. You know, I started doing 5 gallon batches, all grain batches, and yeah, even to this day, my apartment's full of beer, just homebrew everywhere, carboys everywhere. It got out of control really, really quickly.
Are you still homebrewing, even though that you're a professional brewer?
Not anymore. I still have some sours laying around in buckets, but no, I haven't homebrewed in a while.
And what groups and clubs were you part of as you were learning?
The New York City Homebrewers Guild and the Knights of Brooklyn. The Knights of Brooklyn was the first group that we joined. It's a small group that meets at Union Hall in Brooklyn once a month. It's pretty chill.
Yeah, it's amazing how many great groups there are in the city, and I think it's just gotten like more and more popular, and there's just a more and more extensive network of really people who are doing what I think is, you know, everyone's making better beer, you know, technically, creatively, and just having that kind of network of people to learn from, ask questions of, and really get feedback from is really great.
That's great.
Yeah, I don't know if you knew this, Jimmy, but Ale Street News was also born out of home brewing. I used to brew with my brother-in-law partner, Jack Babin, and through that we started a club, and our partners opened a homebrew store, and we started the Ale Street News, the North Jersey Warthogs.
Wow. And where was the first place you sold the newspaper? In the homebrew shop?
We never actually, of course, sold it, but we got it. This is a long story, and you probably heard it. We got some help with Brooklyn Brewery that helped distribute it for us. So they were one of our first advertisers. We sold advertising, but the Homebrew Club used to meet at the front porch in Hawthorne, New Jersey.
That's great. Basil, what is the second beer that you poured for us?
That beer is our Lean Back IPA. It's you know, kind of our easy drinking IPA. It's 5.5%, lots of Amarillo, nice and citrusy, pretty smooth, but I think some, you know, good hot bitterness as well.
That's great. Brendan, what do you think of the Finback beers? And I respect your taste in beers. So.
This is the first chance I've had to try them so far, and I had the coffee. I didn't have the Amarillo one yet.
What did you think of the coffee pour?
Coffee on one was great, and I was going to ask how you added the coffee, but cold brewed post fermentation, right?
Yeah,
that's how I did my my last. I did sort of a breakfast stout clone. I did the same exact way.
So you add cold brew after the fermentation or during?
Yeah,
what
so
time?
Basically after primary fermentation, we drop the yeast, and then we add the beer at that point.
And do you add it to taste, or do you have a specific amount in mind?
A little bit of both. We add it to taste. Like a lot of times we'll try, and it's not always kind of exact, but we'll try to pull samples off from the tank and then kind of, you know, just try to, you know, at a much smaller scale, like on a pint, to put X amount of coffee in and kind of compare, you know, the results. And then we'll kind of say, you know, if we multiply that up into 20 barrels or something, this is how much coffee there is. You know, and sometimes we adjust it a little bit, but usually it, you know, it works out pretty well.
And jumping ahead to the Session IPA, what's the name of it again? There's too many names.
It's Lean Back IPA.
Lean Back. Do you have a trademark on that?
No, we don't. It's the antithesis of Lean In, you know?
I do have to say that I think that there's too many names for beers. I like knowing the brewery, but at some point, I really can't keep track of everyone's little name. You know, some like Ballast Point Sculpin IPA. You know, there's some that you see as standard bearers. But, I mean, I don't know. Do you agree, Tony? Do you think there's too many
names for beers?
Oh, yeah,
and I think it's
beers?
Getting to the point now where you're getting pretty crazy names for breweries as well. In fact, somebody usually puts out a list post-JABF, the most interesting brewery names, you know. Or was it the most interesting beers, perhaps? But, yeah, I mean, there's... We don't want to put limits on creativity, but I know what you mean.
But there must be some strange names of breweries that pop in mind, because you're like been on the forefront for how many years now?
I kind of like Funky Buddha. That's kind of cool down in Florida. As far as names, the Legend of the Liquid Mind is a stout from a brewery out in Colorado. You know.
And Brendan, does some come to mind for you?
Yeah, if you ever have a chance, go take a look at the tap list at Tired Hands in Philadelphia, or just outside of Philadelphia. They have beer names that look like small novels, and they're the best beers I've ever had, but it's like the light that shoots out of the center of your head and that type of thing. I probably didn't get it right, but...
Are they trademarked?
I don't know.
See, if they're long enough, you don't actually have to trademark them, right? If
then it's a book, and you can just copyright it. Yeah.
So good, there's another Verizon beer, you know. This is the part I love about beer, but at some point the business really is an important part of it, you know. And give us a quick summary of what you do, Brendan, with beer and why you want to work with breweries.
Sure. Basically, for breweries, it's a little bit of copyright, you know, to the extent we're talking about labels, but most of the time it's filing for trademarks and then helping brewers that have received cease and desist letters, or, you know, if they want to send a cease and desist letter, which is more rare because the craft beer world is such, there's such camaraderie that it's almost expected that if there's a problem with one brewer, like I think happened with you guys, they'll call each other, like one brewer calling another brewer. And that's definitely what I recommend. I do recommend if you're not sure about what your rights are, maybe talk to a lawyer, but I wouldn't have the lawyers just jump right in and start contacting other brewers right away. But you do want to have some basis for your opinion before you start talking to anybody.
Is it typically a lot of new breweries, they have a name or a label, and then they get a cease and desist order from a larger brewery?
Yeah, because the larger breweries have the resources to, you know, get as many trademarks as they want oftentimes, so there's going to be more, a higher likelihood that the larger brewery is going to be contacting a smaller brewery because they just don't have the resources to trademark everything.
So it's like somebody buying up web addresses or something.
Sure, that happens all the time, and that's another sort of intellectual property, you know, thing you can get into with cyber squatters who, you know, register names that are either the same as your brewery or a slight misspelling of your brewery.
There was a case with Russian River out of California and Avery had the same name for a beer instead of suing each other.
That was a Salvation, right?
I guess it was a Salvation, right. And so instead of suing each other, they just decided to make the same beer. And,
They needed a collaboration, not litigation ale.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
Well, that's the good spirit that we all like, right? Mm-hmm. All right. Hey, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
You are listening to Iggy Dean here on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from Beer Sessions Radio.
Headley, the pastry chef at Del Posto in Manhattan, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. What a cool guy. Brooks Headley, the pastry chef at Del Posto. He's a big fan of Heritage Radio Network, too. Check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. All right, so we've got an interesting show today. Justin Kennedy, our co-producer, and Tony Ford from Illustrated News just came back from GABF, the Great American Beer Fest. We got Brendan Palfreyman, who's a beer trademark lawyer, and Basil and Kevin from Finback. So, but now we're going to just decompress, and Justin, tell us about the GABF.
Well, the GABF it stands for the Great American Beer Festival, and this is the 33rd year they've held it out in Denver, and it's put on by the Brewers Association, and I think this year there were 49,000 attendees, something like 700 breweries, 2,700 beers total, just ridiculous numbers.
3,300, I believe.
3,300, okay. Mm-hmm. And then maybe twice that number actually entered into competition. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it was quite an experience, a long few days, so I'm sure Tony can attest
well,
to.
90 categories of beer, and you Finback guys probably like this. The beer we're tasting now that Justin just poured in, The Grim Double Negative. That was the one that beat out Narwhal for silver. Narwhal got Sierra Nevada got the bronze.
Yeah, so we're drinking the Grim Double Negative, which is an Imperial Stout, and it won silver in the awards, beating out maybe 100 other Imperial Stouts, which was really impressive, I think. I like Grim stuff a lot, but I never really considered them, you know, on that level. But I was pleasantly surprised to see them win.
It's interesting with the style categories. There's 90 different style categories, and they kind of reflect the popular beers going on. Here's some of the biggest, you know, the most entries in categories. The Wooden Barrel Aged Strong Stout, 190. A lot of barrel aged had over 100. Just strong beer in barrels was 105. Urban Spice was kind of 150 entries. I guess it's a big category.
Urban Spice.
Urban Spiced.
Urban Spiced.
As opposed to country.
We're Urban Spice.
Right, yes. And then the Saison style, also over 100, 115. But then when you get into the pale ales, American style pale ale, 145. Amber Red, 140. Imperial IPA, 135. And then, of course, American style IPA, more than double any other category, 279. So
who won in the American style IPA categories, since it's the most popular?
I think Breakside won gold. I don't know who else won.
Some breweries I'm not that familiar with, but actually, where is it? It's right here somewhere.
Well, Tony's looking for that. I know our friend Chief O'Neill won silver for American style pale ale for the NYPA, which was a huge victory, I think.
You're right. It was Breakside IPA from Milwaukee.
I think Breakside's from Oregon. Milwaukee, Oregon?
could be a typo. Half Acre got silver with the Hioka from Chicago. I do know them. And then Columbus Brewing from Ohio got the
It just shows you how many new breweries there are, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, totally. I think almost half of the entries this year, maybe not half, maybe a quarter, were actually first-time entrants, the breweries themselves, not just the beers. So,
While Finback's shooting themselves for not submitting this year, because they probably would have won for the – would you have submitted your coffee porter? I mean, if you could have.
Maybe. I think it's a strong beer. I mean, actually, I feel I'm really excited. You know, we know Joe and Lauren really well, and I'm really excited they won. I think it goes to show that, you know, if you have passion and make good beer, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a tiny brewery, you know, that you know, is only a couple years old and, you know, you beat out people or companies that have been around for a lot longer and they make a lot more beer.
I mean, that's what I would assume it's only the new breweries, but I didn't realize the system. Justin, what's your insight onto the judging process?
I don't have that much. I know next week we have John Hall on the show, and he was a judge this year for the first time. And he wrote a really awesome article for his magazine's website about the whole judging process. So I highly recommend people check that out.
AllAboutBeer.com,
I think. And you can check out John's insightful article. I don't know much about judging myself. I've never had much interest in, you know, going into the judging guidelines and all that. Maybe Brendan has a little bit more interest and knowledge about that. But to me, it's a little bit. I tend to like beers that I like because of multiple reasons. You know, the label, the people behind it, all these other things. This is blind tasting, and it's really a little bit, you know, single-minded,
tedious?
I would say. Yes, I'm sure it's tedious, too.
It is. It's very intensive. You have to judge several rounds over 3 days, I think, you need for another. But they have over 200 judges, and then basically, you know, the beer goes from one round through to another round, and then there is a lot of discussion, if you know, about tie-breaking and that kind of stuff. There's a couple of categories where they didn't award a gold or maybe not a silver because they didn't think anything was, you know, deserving of it.
But right, I noticed that there were a few that were missing certain medals, and I had no idea. I thought it was just a mistake on the
That does happen every year, but you get beers like probably one of the best-known beers, Russian River, Pliny the Elder, in the Imperial IPA category, got a bronze, but it was, you know, beaten by a couple other beers.
Right, which was, you know, not a total surprise, but people tend to, you know, kind of go crazy for that. It would be interesting to see, you know, if maybe Hetty Topper or some of the other Vermont breweries that we tend to think highly of had entered, to see where they would have placed or if they would have placed. But
sure.
So, Brendan, you've been a lot of homebrew competitions. What's the difference between the way they judge in homebrew competitions versus the GABF, you can guess?
I would imagine it's pretty similar. I know homebrew competitions are all done on the BJCP guidelines, the Beer yeah. Judge Certification Program, I think.
As is the GABF.
Okay, yeah. So it's basically, I can tell you, the form along the left side, it has sort of check boxes for typical off flavors, diacetyl butter, acetaldehyde, that type of thing. And then they do, what is it, taste, mouthfeel, aroma, appearance. I think that might be the four or five things that they judge it on.
Yeah, we sat through an IPA tasting in the spring, and I was exposed to the BJCP, you know, style judging for the first time. And to me, it was tough. I could not be a judge of beer. I mean, it took the joy out of it for me, I'll tell you. So anyone that does it, cheers to them. Cheers to the guys that do sit and John yeah. Hall, because I couldn't do it. And I would just pick the coffee porter from Finback, you know, so.
Yeah.
Why don't you? Is there a category for like a coffee porter, Tony? Is that like
yeah? Actually,
a
as I just looked it up, it is a very popular category. 115 entries this year, but I expect that will be subdivided soon to coffee stout, coffee this, you know, like and,
right. There's some really strange categories that you'll see. I think there's one called like fruit beer, and the winner was a raspberry stout from Hardywood Park in Richmond, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And then the other beers in there were nothing like that. I think there was like...
The Hardywood one, really?
Hardy one, yeah.
Oh,
they won gold.
Guys, yeah.
Yeah, they're great. But the other entrants in that category, I don't even know how they judged against one another. They weren't the same styles or the same
you
fruits.
Know, a beer that won the session category, you'll probably never guess it. Oatmeal Stout.
That's pretty awesome.
That's right, but wow. Yeah. You think they have more and more categories so that more and more people...
Oh, they do
awards?
Add every year, yeah. So now it's up to 90 categories.
Yeah, and I think they'll just continue
to get... opposite extreme is a festival where I've judged at the Mondial de la Bière, where there are no categories. You just judge the beer what's in front of you. They even serve it in an opaque glass so you don't see the color. So it's just totally opposite end of the spectrum.
You know, talking about styles and things, you know, there's like New World American, but some people like our friend Matthias Niedhardt at Be United... you know, we had talked about doing a judging of German beers, and his first thought was that no one really knows the traditional styles, so he felt that hardly anyone was qualified to judge. I mean, is that an issue with these judges? I mean, who are these judges?
They are international judges. They made a point of bringing in judges, maybe not so much for the GABF, but they also run the World Beer Cup, and they want to get the legitimacy of having judges from other countries. So I think the judges were from like 12, 15 different countries.
Yeah, and I think it just, you know, the name Great American Beer Festival doesn't mean that it's just Americans judging. I know John Hall had applied maybe 4 years ago to be a judge, and you know they had accepted his application. And in order to even get an application, you have to be nominated by an existing judge or maybe a group of existing judges. And John had to wait 4 years for a spot to open. So this was the first year he was actually eligible to be a judge.
It sounds like FIFA World Cup referees. And the guy doesn't speak English, and he's talking to someone in Portuguese, right? I mean... Well, cheers to that. That's a great thing. And so, Justin, how about the highlights of Denver? You know, I know you go to these festivals, but then you really actually hang out in pubs and breweries.
The
real people.
The festival itself, I can only handle about maybe half an hour before I'm just ready to leave. The hall gets really crowded, and it really smells bad, and it's like a mix of hot dogs and farts and beer, and it's just disgusting.
Was this your first year, Justin?
This is only my second year, but. Yeah, I have a very low tolerance for that. But that being said, there's a lot of other really cool events going on. And one of the coolest ones I went to was a sour beer event that Crooked Stave put on called What the Funk. And it was maybe, I don't know, 100 different breweries, including, I brought some bottles here, Wicked Weed. And
well, let's pop Crook, Wicked Weed.
Crooked Stave, of course. And it was all sours. And by the end of the 4 hours, my throat was just completely raw and I was in need of some water or something else, but it was a really cool event. And
so a lot of the best things happened.
Yeah, I think a lot of the
There's a lot of side events.
So many cool things.
What is like a favorite watering hole in Denver that you?
Well, the Falling Rock is still the classic place run by Chris Black, and the lineup there didn't seem to be as big. Sometimes it's like you just have to wait, no matter who you are. But maybe that's because I went while sessions were on at the festival. I went to a really cool event at Epic Brewing where they put on 50 cask ales that they made them all themselves at their brewery, and that's right next to downtown Denver. there's just a lot of new places. Obviously, the Wind Coop is still going strong. You got Rock Bottom on 60th mm-hmm. is a main place. But you can walk. There's a walkway across the river from Wind Coop now, where there's great drinking areas.
Yeah, I mean, you walk down the street and you just run into brewery after brewery. I went to a heavy metal themed brewery called True, T-R-V-E. That was really cool and, you know, really small and intimate and had a certain, you know, heavy metal satanic theme to it. But that was a lot of fun. And then
what were the beers like?
The beers were pretty good. I mean, they had some, you know, IPAs and dark sours and other, you know, kind of trendy styles. But, yeah, they were pretty good. It was more about the style, I think, than the beers themselves. But, and I also went to Denver Beer Company for some kind of collaboration festival that they did, and a few others. I don't remember. There were so many around that I couldn't even keep track.
For Basil and Kevin, so you guys, as new brewers, I mean, what does it mean to you to go to GABF? Would you ever go? Is it expensive?
I think next year, if we can do it, we'd definitely like to go. I actually have never been to GABF. I've heard all the stories about it. It sounds like it would be fun. I think, just being with a ton of people and having a lot of beer. I don't know. I think beer, farts, and hot dogs sounds pretty good. I don't know.
Trademark that.
what's the number one merch? I'm sure that breweries have merchandise. They have pins, T-shirts, tattoos. What was the number one thing that people give?
T-shirts by far were the number one, not free thing, but, you know, you saw lots of T-shirts. I think I saw more brewery T-shirts than, you know, just normal T-shirts. People, you know, well, either wearing local pride stuff or...
I mean, they have a booth at the festival, but you have to, you know, it's run by the organizers, so they take their cut, but that's where you put your stuff to sell. You can't, unless you have your own merchandise booth, you can't
sell. So there's somebody that actually sells all the T-shirts?
Yeah, basically.
Wow.
But we've been going for 21 years, and we take a group there. We missed last year, we take a group out, and... you know, everyone's, we have these pin guys that they have waistcoats like just full of bottle cap pins. They always get their picture taken in the festival. People have different types of memorabilia, and there's crazy headgear going on.
The costumes this year were, I saw people dressed up as cats for no apparent reason. there were, you know, people in...
Are they trademarked?
I don't know about that.
Superman costumes. You know, it was almost like Comic-Con meets a beer festival, and it was a little bit more than I could handle, but, you know, people were definitely having a lot of fun.
They do dress up for it. They do weddings there now. Like
There was a chapel saw.
They have a group wedding. That
GABF wedding.
People save up their wedding date for the GABF. I mean, it's become a tradition, get married
Justin,
to the GABF.
Justin, I'm going to Denver next month. From your experience, what's the one place I should visit in Denver for good beer?
The one place you should go is a place called Euclid Hall. I had dinner there with our friend Josh Bernstein on Thursday night before we went to the festival, and it was just a beautiful space. The food was awesome, and the draft list is impeccable. So I would say Euclid Hall in Denver, Colorado.
Tony, for you?
At Falling Rock, just for the history.
All right. And then Brandon, our beer trademark lawyer, you just popped a beer. What is it?
This is one I picked up. I did a little pilgrimage to Vermont, Burlington, the IPA highway, and this is a Spruce Tip IPA that was a collaboration between Sean Lawson and the Vermont Pub and Brewery.
That's great. Let's all drink that. And then, Brandon, thanks so much for suggesting the show, the Beer Trademark Show. Are there, can you mention a couple of breweries or beer-related things that you've represented?
Yeah.
If you can, it's okay.
Yeah, I don't like to talk about current clients if I can, but I mean, one of my clients, which I'm very, very proud of, and I brought a growler stuff today, is a little nano brewery in Syracuse called Eastwood Brewing Company, run by my friend Pete Kirkgasser from the Salt City Homebrew Club, and they're just doing great stuff there on a really, really small
and
scale.
And what did you do? You gave them, help them trademark the name
of this
brewery?
Yeah, just gave them general advice about
things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you're a great guy, man. I appreciate you listening to the show and tweeting and everything, and thanks so much. And Tony, again, Ale Street News.
Yeah, we got the new issue out, the October-November edition, and been very busy lately, the GABF and things, so we'll be starting to plan our Belgian trip. Actually, that goes off in the spring.
But you told me, so when did you first publish Ale Street News?
1992.
And then originally, how did you publish it then? Like,
hand-pasted
photos.
Back in the old days, we bought a waxing machine. You know, you got to wax the sheets, and then after that we finally got a full-size printer so we could do the photographs and the copy. We still had to paste the ads down, and then after a number of years we started working with a team up in Montreal. They run the Mondial de la Bière Festival actually, and they took us digital and they do all the page setup for us, which sooner or later you got to do. But back
well, then,
in the
you
early
said,
days
going back, so you have a lot of great traditions, including Jim Cook from Sam Adams. So
yeah,
what happened at GABF? You said there was
I'm on the judging panel for the long shot homebrew competition, and they give out the awards there in Denver. They do a brunch every year. I think Justin was there.
I was there.
But you told me that there's a story you have to tell me. There's a line that Jim Cook asked you to finish.
I was
finish.
Standing there, and Jim Cook, he's telling the history. And remember when American beer was like, honeymooners in a canoe. And he's like, Tony, you know the answer. I mean, the place is full.
What's
I'm
the
like,
answer?
Well, as I said, they're both effing close to water.
That was the old days. But it's great to have you on as historical perspective. And we love Ale Street News, dude. And Basil and Kevin, thanks for bringing that coffee porter. I love it, man.
Thank you.
Where can we get it?
My pleasure. We actually just released it, so you'll find it at cool New York City bars soon, probably this coming week. Let's see. We're actually just a couple of little things we're doing. There's going to be an awesome kind of New York City local tap takeover at the Pony Bar Upper East Side tomorrow night. It's going to be, I don't know, pretty much all of the New York City breweries. I think, us, Other Half, I think Grimm's going to be there, Third Rail, Gun Hill, Flagship. I think, a bunch of people. So if you want to go out and just try a lot of New York City beer, definitely go there. And then we're doing a pig roast on this Sunday at the brewery.
October 12th.
Check out our Facebook page.
Sure, Glendale, Queens.
Yeah.
What's the nearest subway?
It's the M train to Myrtle.
And then, if I was coming to New York City and I wanted to visit all the breweries, I would definitely go to Finback. You have a great space, and we're looking forward to trying all your great beers. And Justin, the final words on GABF and Denver.
A lot of fun. I highly recommend it. I met a lot of great people from all over the country, and it's a great networking and just hanging out town and time to be in Denver. It's really awesome.
All right, and we're just going to give one last push. On this Saturday, October 11th, if you're in New York City, we're producing the Oktoberfest Seaport. We've got a lot of great small New York City breweries, including Radiant Pig, Secret Engine, Other Half, and some Gravity Cast from Bamberg in Franconia, Germany. That's going to be pretty awesome. And a special shout-out to our good friends at DBA. They're celebrating their 20th year anniversary on Sunday, October 19th. Go to DBA in the East Village. We lost our good friend Ray Dieter, and his other partner, Dennis, also died this year. So they're still going strong. But go support DBA if you're in New York City, Sunday, October 19th, the 20th anniversary. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who've helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Brendan, Basil, Kevin, Tony, and Justin for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Maggie Seid and Justin Kennedy. And our engineer tonight, Joe Galarraga, Blast from the Past. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Yeah. Woo!
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.